thanks a lot for the kind introduction. Sorry for no neuroscience. But I think it's a very exciting time for black hole physics, and I'm sure almost everyone or everyone in this room agrees. And I've put that why I think it's exciting in this plot here, where you see source mass of some system and the curvature. And so then you can put in some objects that we know more or less well, and also their gravitational field, which it's a little sketchy to indicate it like that, but it basically goes down. It stays at the same source mass, but goes down in curvature, at least in spherical symmetry. That's a good approximation. And so the best data that we have stems either from, well, experiments right here on Earth or in the solar system. These would be the solar system planets, or from laboratory tests of gravity. Although this is actually pretty hard to do.
Sorry, the best systems that we have for what?
The best constraints that we get for, well, if you collapse the plot onto one scale.
So the constraints on what? Sorry.
On the gravitational potential.
So you don't like stellar mass black holes?
No, I'm not saying I don't like stellar mass black holes. So this is where a horizon forms, and that's, of course, now the probably best constraints that we have on dynamical gravitation come from stellar mass objects, that I fully agree with. And so there's a horizon forming here, and so there's something qualitatively different happening to the theory. A cosmology would be somewhere down here, and where I did my PhD, quantum gravity would be somewhere, well, way through the roof up there. This is also an interesting frontier for some people because you reach here you reach the Planck mass, you don't reach Planck curvature. So that's just the broad picture of this plot. And I think it's very interesting to just probe for black hole uniqueness, or more generally, for uniqueness of the external space-time of your object, basically without prior through that plot. And I'll make a case for why I wouldn't put a prior on where to search for objects. Many people tell me that you should probe at the highest possible curvature scale, so up here. The first part of my talk will be an example of where that's not necessarily the spot to look at. So that will be probably the first 20 minutes or so. Please ask questions whenever you want. If I don't get through anything, I'm more than happy to not get through. And then the second part, we'll use that basically as a motivation to set up what I consider a useful framework of using VLBI observations, so shadow observations, to probe this black hole uniqueness. And then if I get to it, I'll return to Lewis' favorite corner in that plot, which is the stellar mass ranged up here. All right. So to get started, where do we expect new physics? And I'll go first through a standard scalarization example, so just a scalar field, non-minimally coupled to gravity. And then I'll basically what we asked us here in this work is what do I need to fiddle with in that theory to make it not occur at the highest curvature scale? And I hope that this becomes clear. So I'll go through the standard mechanism of scalarization, and then I give the standard example, which is scalar Gauss-Bonnet theory, where you just couple the scalar to Gauss-Bonnet curvature. One uses the Gauss-Bonnet curvature such that you maintain second-order equations of motion. All right, so then the general setup for that is you want to have a theory which admits the vacuum solutions of GR with a constant scalar field profile. And then it's a question of whether these solutions are stable or not. And for that, you can look essentially at the effective mass term for that scalar. So you write down perturbations on your specific spacetime. So your spacetime is here encoded in the specific box operator, which depends on the metric, of course. And then there might also be non-minimal couplings, which contribute to this effective mass here. And then on that given spacetime, that mass is either positive or negative or zero. And if the effective mass is in that notation, I guess, positive, then you have a tachyonic instability in the system.
So
And that tachyonic instability drives the scalar field away from the vacuum solution with constant scalar field profile. And this is what people call the onset of scalarization. And then, of course, people can follow that dynamics, for instance, in nonlinear evolution, and see what the endpoint of that instability is. And what one typically finds is that the nonlinear dynamics quenches that linear instability, so it reduces the instability again, and the theory settles into a new stable state, which is then a hairy black hole or a non-GR black hole. So that's the very standard story. And here's the example that I want to give. That's the Gauss-Bonnet curvature, so some specific combination of the curvature scalars. You have some coupling, which in this notation I think is length scale squared. You have the usual Einstein term, and you have a kinetic term for the scalar field. And then there's conditions. These conditions are necessary to fulfill this first setup condition, that it's that every vacuum solution of GR is also a solution to that theory. And the final condition is just you can rewrite it as some constant you can absorb into that coupling. And then the coupling to the Gauss-Bonnet, and of course the value of the Gauss-Bonnet on your particular spacetime and at your particular spacetime point, sets the effective mass and therefore determines whether scalarization occurs or not, or at least the onset of scalarization occurs or not. And that is a very good example for this notion that you would expect new physics at high curvature scales, because at least in spherical symmetry, the Gauss-Bonnet scalar is basic, or there are no other curvature invariants. So the Gauss-Bonnet scalar is just scaling like 1 over, I think, r to the 6. And so that means that the more compact your object, so the higher the horizon curvature in the case of a black hole, the stronger this effect, and therefore the stronger this effect on mu effective, and therefore the stronger the scalarization channel. Yeah?
Sorry, what is hair here?
What is it? What?
Hair.
Hair? Yeah. In that sense, it's a non-trivial scalar field profile.
Oh, not delta phi, right? It is the scalar field itself is the hair.
So yeah, in this equation, you can't see the hair because I've linearized. Or you can only see the perturbation of hair around. So you would have to write down a nonlinear, you would have to complete this equation with the nonlinear terms, and then you would get a solution where the metric deviates from GR, and there's additionally a scalar field profile which is non-trivial. But it's right that also the metric can, and in this case at least does, vary from the metric of a Schwarzschild black hole, for instance. All right, so this is a good example of why you expect new physics or anything. Basically this coupling determines now your scale, and it's tied to the highest curvature scales. So if you put it at the scale of supermassive black holes, you will also scalarize all other black holes, and in fact the constraints on this coupling are then the tightest, the smaller the object, or the higher the curvature. Now, there's a small exception here, or to spin, because in fact, if you go to a Kerr black hole, this invariant is already non-trivial. So it's a little subtle what you even mean by curvature. And it turns out that this Gauss-Bonnet invariant can switch the sign in the ergosphere of a rotating black hole, of a sufficiently fast rotating black hole. And so then, depending again on the sign of your alpha 1, you can have or have not non-trivial scalarization around highly spinning or not highly spinning black holes. All right, but still then it occurs for all black holes in the same way. Now, we were looking at modifications that break this paradigm, and in fact the modification is in some sense surprisingly simple that you have to make. So what I'm doing is I'm adding a second scalar. And if you go through the equations of motion of this action, it's a non-dynamical scalar. So if you vary with respect to psi, you just get a constraint on, and that constraint basically replaces the psi by some additional Gauss-Bonnet, so it solves this equation. And therefore, you can also think of the theory as a theory where you've just added a Gauss-Bonnet squared. whichever way you want to think about the theory maintains second order equations of motion. It's not, I think, part of, or at least not trivially part of scalar tensor theories, so not part of Hondesky, but it's part of biscalar Hondesky.
And is there a natural way to motivate such a theory?
What do you mean by natural?
Whatever, just principles underlying, beyond trying to come up with a counterexample, what principles underlying the desire to write something up?
Well, I mean, one principle is that I wouldn't expect just one power of a curvature invariant to be present. And in fact, I would expect a tower of curvature invariants to be present, and then I would expect the dimension, I mean, if you trust naturalness, you would expect the dimensionless couplings to be all of the same order. And in fact, that's the regime that will be interesting. Yeah?
That's your opposite second order, right? The derivative.
Sorry, say again? This one?
No, I mean the action. Up to which order do you consider?
So I'm not trying to write down the most general thing up to a certain order in derivatives. Of course, there are second-order derivatives in the Gauss-Bonnet. And so if you square the Gauss-Bonnet, there are twice second-order derivatives. But the fact that there's only second-order derivatives and this particular form of the Gauss-Bonnet maintains second-order equations of motion.
The second order is related to the initial condition. Somehow underlying assumption that you have the same number of initial conditions, you have a linearized action or...
Yes, it's important for the degrees of freedom, and that's why we wanted to maintain this here. Because if you don't maintain the order of the equations of motion, you get additional initial conditions, right? Or you need additional initial conditions, and these correspond to new degrees of freedom and typically correspond to wrong sign kinetic term degrees of freedom, which are potentially dangerous. If I get to the third part, I will show you a theory where that happens. All right. So the rest is the exact same story. You need to maintain the same conditions. There's the onset of scalarization, but now there's a second contribution to the effective mass, which comes either from you phrasing the theory as a Gauss-Bonnet squared or from applying this, this non-dynamical scalar constraint. And so the effective mass for that scalar phi now depends on two different powers of the Gauss-Bonnet. And if I pick the signs of the couplings such that this coupling works against scalarization and this coupling works in favor of scalarization, then in regimes where the Gauss-Bonnet curvature is very large, you stabilize the scalar around this constant scalar field profile.
But in such regimes where the g-square competes effectively against the g, then the very same arguments that you said.
That is correct. That is correct. And therefore, I think you can just understand this as the theory needs to introduce a second scale, and that scale is not tied naturally to the cutoff if you want to write it down as an EFT. That's correct. All right, but if you accept that non-naturalness, then this is a surprisingly simple, to my opinion, example how you can have new physics which is not necessarily tied to curvature. And I'll be more precise on that in a second. In that way here, so here you have the coupling ratio of these two couplings, and I'm assuming I can scale out the other coupling with the mass of the black hole. So then I get a two-dimensional plot. And what you see is the hatched region is the region in which the Schwarzschild solution suffers from this tachyonic instability. So scalarization appears. And so if you go to some finite and between 0 and 0.9 or something like that number of that ratio, then what you get is a finite window of masses in which you scalarize your solutions. Now, for now, I have not talked about the fact what then happens to that scalarization channel. And indeed, we do not yet have any way of assessing this theory in nonlinear dynamics. What we can do is we can obtain the new branch of solutions. And the new branch of solutions exists in this range of the theory space. There's a little bit of hard numerics to do here to flesh this out. But thanks to Pedro Fernandez's nice code, we can obtain these new solutions here. Now, I will not spend time talking on the properties of these new solutions, but you can think of them really as a second branch. It's continuously connected to the GR branch up here, and it's not continuously connected down here. And so the physical picture would be, if you have a black hole in this mass range, I presume it decays down to the other branch. But that we haven't followed that non-dynamically, so I'm not sure that this is actually what happens.
Sorry, but these studies where you see it's scatters, this whether Linear analysis show that it's being below the air?
That's the black hatched region. The red is the actual nonlinear solution to the theory in that regime.
So why, I'm confused, why is it that you haven't resolved the problem?
Well, we haven't resolved the transition.
But you do find solutions.
We do find new solutions.
You don't know how to.
But for instance, we do not know whether this branch is stable. It could be that both branches are unstable. That's not typically what happens in the usual scalarization, but we don't know. All right. So with the caveat of naturalness, or a new scale appearing, this is a way where you can scalarize black holes in a finite mass window. And of course, you can now choose to pick that mass window. And I can choose it to be, or I mean, I can choose it. The theory chooses that for you. And that can happen at supermassive scales, or at solar mass scales, or at any other scale, which we sadly cannot probe. Let me also just quickly spend that you might be worried, and people in scalarization are often worried about the question, because a neutron star is sometimes even more compact than black holes, and therefore you can be worried whether neutron stars scalarize or other compact objects like Earth, and we wanted to at least figure that out in the spherically symmetric case. And so you can also solve for a neutron star solution. Of 1.4 solar masses is what we picked here. And then we pick the first coupling, or that basically sets one scale. We pick that of the order of at least significantly heavier black holes. And then this is the ratio that I was referring to before. And so the blue line here is the usual scalar Gauss-Bonnet case, where the second coupling is just zero. And there you see that there is some instability happening, but if you scale with the coupling to larger and larger values up to order one, then indeed there's no negative region in the effective potential occurring. And therefore, especially inside the star, there's a very strong and positive effective potential. And therefore, we don't expect that neutron stars, at least the spherically symmetric ones, scalarize in that theory. All right, and from that, I mean, for that specific theory, there's a bunch of funny things that I think may remain to be looked at. The rotating solutions, which should also be available with this code, and then the question of stability that I already alluded to, and the actual nonlinear transition to the G. That's just it. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. Yes. But I'm not particularly married to this theory. I think it's just the statement that if you start introducing two scales which mix different curvature and powers of curvature invariance, you can get much more non-trivial effects on non-GR branches in general. And if you have multiple branches, this conclusion about the highest curvature scale to me is not necessarily true. So I think it's worth looking at all corners in this plot and being agnostic about the scale or multiple scales of new physics. And so I want to view this plot as the test for black hole uniqueness in general. So thinking about black holes in GR, we know that they are all unique. They are all described by the Kerr solution. And so we can effectively collapse down this plot. And we know that all these solutions should externally have at least the same mass and the same angular momentum. There's actually theorems for that in GR. And so that's maybe something that we might want to keep an eye open whenever we have a new observational channel. And for supermassive black holes, the new observational channel that we currently have, at least until LISA comes online, which, by the way, is exciting that it got funded now, is shadow observations that Avery knows very, very well. And so the next part of my talk is going to be on that topic. Before I get there, I want to pause for more questions.
I have a very main question, maybe. Why the scalar that we have added to the ordinary GR is not considered an ordinary normal team union? Because of what?
Because it's non-minimally coupled to curvature. And so you see that right here. So the Gauss-Bonnet, I mean, if this is a if this has non-trivial shape, the function, then the scalar has some non-minimal. So, right, a team you knew, you would write down as a just in terms of covariant derivatives as a kinetic term, and then some scalar field interactions without coupling the scalar to curvature again.
Still, I cannot understand why it is a degrees of freedom of the grid, not matter. Okay, we have a matter, we have non-minimally coupled it to gravity.
To me, the distinction between whether it's a degree of freedom or of gravity or not is strict if you couple minimally, or at least well, then we have all the theorems of GR available to us. But if you couple non-minimally, I don't even know of a great way of determining whether a degree of freedom belongs to gravity or not. I mean, everything just couples to each other. And in particular, changing phi will back react in a different way on the metric, as would the theorems of GR with minimally coupled matter tell you. Yeah.
So this expression, you probably reminds me of Dunbar's theory on discretization, and this is essentially the order. So I'm wondering whether there are any idea to apply Dunbar's theory to this kind of picture.
So there is discussion about defining entropy for these black holes, and whether you can define an entropy such that you can associate your transition such that you always end up in the state with the lowest entropy. But I'm not aware of anything specific beyond that. All right. Good. Then with this admittedly long motivation, let me today get to VLBI observations and this beautiful image of the Event Horizon Telescope collaboration. And I want to point out before I get into specifics, two aspects of this image. One is this central dark region, and one is this ring-like feature. And both are qualitative and even quantitative signatures in that image, and both can be used to constrain the underlying spacetime. And I want to first talk a little bit about the central brightness depression there. And I think what this can really tell us is the question whether maybe there is no horizon, and can we rule that out? Because that's kind of the most violent thing. Whoops, even so violent. The most violent thing that you can do to the black hole is just remove its horizon. Right? Then it's not even a black hole anymore. And then it should get some interior emission in that image. All right. Then if that's not the case, then you can think about other modifications. And you can ask the question whether there is a structure to that ring-like feature. Somehow this also broke. Oh, perfect. All right. So I want to first spend time on the question whether there is a horizon or not. So my model, and that's really just a very naive model for whether or not you can have a horizon, is a particular regular spacetime, by which I mean that all curvature invariants, at least all invariants that you can form solely from the Riemann tensor, are finite in that spacetime. And then the spin of that spacetime, very similarly to Kerr, just serves as something that can remove the horizon in principle. So if you dial the spin high enough, above a bound which corresponds in Kerr to the value of 1, you lose your horizon, and then of course you incur you have a naked singularity. Here you don't. There's still issues of potentially having closed time-like curves, but essentially you end up with a wormhole space-time in this. So you have a transition with spin between a black hole and a wormhole space-time. And I will make the additional assumption that on the other throat of the wormhole, there's no emission. I don't consider the other throat of the wormhole to be physical, but I think it's the most conservative assumption that you can make about the interior region in terms of constraining it with the image feature, namely that there's no other emission. If there's some surface of the object, like a star, then we have even additional emission from the star. So it's a conservative assumption. That's the black hole picture that you get. And if you ray trace the wormhole geometry, this is the picture that you get. So just to quickly explain qualitatively what happens here, there's additional ring-like structures which occur in the central part of the image. That's, you can think about emitting material around the black hole, which also generates you this curve, and which I'll talk about later in much more detail. And you have on geodesics, which traverse through that emitting material, then traverse through the central region, which otherwise would be inside the black hole, and then go out to asymptotic infinity, and in particular end up at the camera. And that forms these additional ring-like features. And so you have some excess brightness inside of this overall brightest feature, right? And so you should be able to see that, or at least constrain that excess emission with your image. And so what really matters there is the brightness floor in the image. Yeah?
This discrete structure, why did you do 4 or 5?
Uh-huh. So in the limit of when you form the horizon, you get outside infinitely many images. You also get, you stack inside as well to infinitely many images. So in fact, you can think of each of the images as coming in pairs. So as you go up in Lyapunov counting, you have the infinite order image, which is one pair, and then the -1, -2, and so on. And so if you remove the horizon, what you do is you start annihilating first the infinite order image and then successively more images. And at this particular value, there's like 5 images inside left and also 5 images outside left.
So what happens if you now dial in that parameter? Do you eventually feel that completely interior?
Dialing it up towards larger spin?
Yeah.
Yeah, then you combine more and more of those rings, and then eventually you just have one outside and one inside left.
So I guess two quick questions. So the first is, what do you assume about the emission region that you're producing rings inside? And second, what is the gray circle?
Both very good questions. So first, the emission region. We assume that the emission region is only on our side of the wormhole. So it's a near equatorial thin disk model, which emits with a particular radial profile in that case. But the fact that it makes these additional ring structures is not at all tied to the profile.
Does it cut off? I mean, is there a photon orbit, a circular photon orbit, and does it cut off before the photon orbit?
I think this has some emission inside the photon orbit.
Am I right in suspecting that the inner rings are dependent upon how much emission you have inside the photon
orbit? I don't think the existence of inner rings depends on that. What does depend on it is, of course, the relative brightness between the rings.
What's the gray?
The gray is the even more interesting question. That's the region which I have just cut out because I don't trust the fact that there's a region inside the wormhole in which you have closed time-like curves. So I really don't buy that model there. So if there's something that forms from dynamical collapse, it must do something different there. And so any trajectory, any geodesic which traverses that region, I don't want to account for additional emission because I don't know my model there.
But how did you accept it closed timeline curves the second you made
one? I agree. But the goal of this exercise was not to create a wormhole, but to create an object without horizon. In fact, I was unhappy that it's a wormhole.
Question, what is the size of this gray region where they have like closed timeline
That's also a question that I was interested in. For instance, the question, if you scale to the critical value, whether that region can vanish? And the answer is no. It's a finite size, which is dependent on the mass of the object. So it's not something that scales away with sufficiently. For instance, if you modify the space-time sufficiently close to the singularity, you can't get rid of that region.
Yeah, that's interesting. My head was trying to compare this size to
so I don't know the exact value, but it's inside the would-be horizon. So it's inside the region which is the where the throat is the narrowest. So it's really at the center of your space-time in some sense. And I think it's roughly 1 m away from where the horizon forms.
So how come you can get like a lot of
you shouldn't think of these extra rings as coming from an additional unstable photon orbit. So the effect is there some So if I would draw the effective potential as a function of R in the on one side of the throat, it would still have one unstable point. So there, on the other side of the throat, there would be another photon shell. But on the side that matters to us, there's only one. The rings really come from material in the disk now also being able to approximate that curve from the other direction, right? You get all the usual photon rings from unstable orbits, which approximate from one side. And the other ones you can't see because they always end up in the horizon. But here, now that there is no horizon, then you can get a similar stack of rings from the others.
If we start the accretion disk somewhere outside, like 10 m, for instance.
Yes.
Outside of, let's say, typical 3 m that we have, right? Or I'm assuming it would get just like normal, right?
It's similar. If you start the accretion disk at 10 m, and you have a horizon, you also get infinitely many rings. Right, because you can orbit infinitely many times.
Yeah, but I'm going to get like something more similar to the one.
Wait, we hold this for a
second. Sure.
So I can continue, and then we will.
Sounds good. All right. So to me, that's just some model which gives me excess brightness emission in some sense. One interesting fact about the model is also that you can scale down this parameter, which is in this case the spin, to the transition. And what we wanted to know is that if you scale it just an epsilon away, so the moment where you annihilate the horizon is the moment where you start to get these features. That's just the statement that the existence of a horizon is a non-local feature in some sense of the space-time. And that's exactly where this excess emission instantaneously comes from. All right, so now let's go to the observational side. We were taking this image and running it through a typical synthetic image pipeline of the Event Horizon Telescope. First, just for the usual EHT array that observations have already been taken with, and then with some additional stations, which are prospect of being added to the array. And then you get some visibility amplitude, right? This is also a reminder that the observations take place in the Fourier plane, which sometimes is also called the UV plane. And this is the distance in that UV plane from the central point. So it's just, you can think of this as going around on a radial curve and always putting the UV distance on that plot. And here you see a comparison of the actual recorded data and both a horizonless and a space-time with horizon. There should actually be a horizon. All right. And then the following pipeline is to analyze the brightness in the central region of the image. We obtain a synthetic observation by going by putting all the different stations and going through this UV analysis. Here we use the EHD imaging tool. Then we fit a geometric template, which also someone here at PI has developed, with the VIDA tool. And having fitted that geometric template, you can distinguish, well, it tells you a ring size, and then you can distinguish the region of the ring and the region interior to the ring, and then you just go back to your original image and you sum up the flux that you get in the ring and that you get in the interior region. That gives you a well-defined quantity, which sort of is an indicator for how much brightness depression you have in the center of the image. I'll give an intuitive picture for that in a second. And that's this quantity here. And in this paper, we did that for a bunch of different arrays to figure out whether additional stations make that observable better. And what you see is that even with current data, you get some preference for the case of a horizon, although the preference is not particularly strong. But if you add stations to the EHT array, and in particular, if you go to currently the discussed configurations which are supposed to be added, then you really get a very strong preference for the case of a horizon instead of in this case, there's no data. You get a very strong difference between the horizon or not, which you should be able to tell apart with data. You say it could also have other angular momentum?
No, so I mean, what I'm saying is the left side. So on one side, suppose the object has an angular momentum that's much lower than 0.9. So your template against which you're comparing might be very off. Not only
Oh, very off to the actual data, you mean?
Yeah, the actual data.
That's right. So in principle, if you wanted to figure out this whole exercise again with some other transition not done by spin, I really think the main thing here is that you get like about 10% additional emission in the central region. And whether you get that from a spin transition or not. But you're right, in principle, all these answers are specific to the model. That's the most conservative state.
Your spin is the most important thing, then, right? So the flux that leaks into the interior would be less.
No, I mean, just pointing my finger there is because especially the model on the left is a very special one. Who is to say that tomorrow someone will call another model in similar horizon, but it's far closer in numbers to case.
But this is exactly what I claim is not necessarily possible, right? I mean, maybe in order one number, yes, but the fact that you have a horizon or not really changes the picture of like what geodesics can arrive at your screen, right?
Well, I suppose I just made up a model where all the interior emission is thrown into the other side of the throat.
It's not interior emission. The emission that you see comes from emission from outside of the object or object. It's still the same emission model in that sense. All right, so these are the images, just to give you an image understanding of that. So the template would fit that ring, and then this shadow area would be 1 sigma away from that ring, so it would be this interior region. And of course, the ring region is much brighter, so this is a small number, and the smaller it gets, the higher the brightness depression. And you can even by eye now see in the images, the upper image is the case without horizon, and the lower line is the case with horizon. And as I go to the right, I add additional stations. I think here it's 5 additional stations, and here it's 10 additional stations, and also higher frequency capability, which adds resolution to the image. And so what you see is that in the case of a black hole, you really start to resolve a very steep central brightness depression, which in this marker leads to this very small number. While here you don't, And in fact, with the 345 gigahertz observation, you even start to resolve some form of structure in the interior, which corresponds to the additional rings. All right. And that also ends that part. I think that distinguishing black holes from horizonless objects is something that we're kind of on the verge of becoming detectable. Are there questions with respect to that part? Because otherwise, I will now turn to, I will keep the horizon, which I think is a more conservative assumption. And then I will ask, what can I tell about the actual space-time exterior to the horizon? And I want to ask two questions here. The first is, how do we even set up a parametric framework of that external space-time? I don't want to impose any dynamics. So I just want to parameterize an arbitrary space-time. And then the second question will be how we might disentangle the astrophysics, because the accretion disk has a lot of astrophysics, which is also not perfectly understood, from the geometry, if we want to constrain the geometry. And here, I want to be as conservative as possible. So I want to be sure that the constraints, or the, in that case, projected constraints, are still valid, even if the accretion model changes. All right, so let me first talk a little bit about stationary and axisymmetric spacetimes. That's a little bit mathy, so bear with me, but I think it's an important point. So stationary and axisymmetric, of course, means that we have two Killing vectors, which I'll call xi and eta here. That, of course, gives us symmetry and therefore reduces the way that you can write down a metric and the way that the space-time can be. In particular, you can pick coordinates which are adapted to these symmetries, and then you only have all the metric elements depending on two coordinates. Otherwise, it's surprising how rich still the subclass of possible different solutions is if you do not impose GR. Of course, if you impose GR, there are lots of restrictions to that, but also if you impose GR, it's just Kerr. If you impose vacuum GR. There's one subclass of that, which is circular spacetimes, which means that these are the two Killing vectors indicated here, and I'm collapsing the two other...
Sorry. So why do you say if you impose GR, it's just Kerr?
If I impose vacuum GR, I should have said.
Well, it's not just Kerr. Well, you could have different... multiple moments, right? Like they'll have axis symmetry, but different multiple moments from Kerr.
You're right. There's also in axis symmetry, there's other solutions. You're absolutely right. I have to impose that there's just, I think, one non-degenerate Killing horizon and an asymptotic region, and then I get Kerr.
Okay.
So, this circular class, you can understand in a somewhat intuitive way by having two surfaces being spanned by the two Killing vectors, and then two surfaces orthogonal locally on that two surface. And if you can extend that to two foliation throughout the entire spacetime, then the spacetime is circular. If you cannot do that, if you can only do that locally, then the spacetime is not circular. And the name circular does not have anything to do with image features or so. It really comes from the fact that this was first discussed in terms of electromagnetism coupled minimally to GR. And then circular electromagnetic fields lead to circular spacetimes, while if you have non-circular electromagnetic fields, you can have non-circular spacetimes, even in minimally coupled electromagnetism and GR. All right, and then you can go to further reduced classes. Of course, there's the class of if you reduce really the actual Killing symmetry to a static case, that has no solutions in, well, again, there might be exotic solutions even in GR. And then you have a class which has an additional hidden symmetry in which we all know that the Kerr solution exists. So where this hidden symmetry is then the Carter constant. But more generally, you could have some other rank 2 Killing tensor, which would then act similar to the Killing tensor of Kerr spacetime and generate an extra constant of motion. And then you have, inside of all of that, you have static and spherically symmetric spacetimes. So if I want to put the black hole solutions of GR back in that plot, then I can put Schwarzschild on the boundary here, and I put it on the boundary just because I want to be able to show how it deforms into Kerr. And if it deforms into Kerr, it remains all the way throughout, even for arbitrary small spin, it remains in this class of hidden symmetry spacetimes. All right. And that's the generic form of that spacetime, which was written down already in the 80s. It has this rank 2 Killing tensor, which you can also give in that generic form, and so on and so on. I think it's important to tell these classes apart. Here is another one of them. And here would be the circular class, which then has more free metric elements that you can write down, so it has more freedom. And you could even, in principle, want to write down a non-circular deviation from Kerr. And I think it's useful to be clear about what class you're looking at, because, well, you're imposing some structure on your deviations. I want to be concerned with the circular class, for which several parameterizations have been proposed, and I will stick to this so-called Konoplia-Rezola-Jedenko parameterization. Yes?
For a spherical study, we don't need to wear a tensor, right?
That's right. But then, because the additional constant of motion is trivial.
I expected to see something related to subsection related to separable solution. That's why we need
to. The separable solutions are the ones which are here.
But we don't need a tensor for this one.
Well, but I think, oh, you mean you would expect that, yeah? Well, I'll have to think about whether the in that picture the static spherically symmetric is actually a point.
Exactly.
That might be correct. All right, so that's the space-time that we write down. I just want to be complete. There's a bunch of coefficients, and the only thing that you need to take away from this is that it's a lot. It's actually lots of infinite towers of coefficients, so there's lots of things that you can, in principle, do to put deviations. That also makes sense, right? You can just put some bump into the spacetime. These parameters classify the leading asymptotics, and then this whole block here is quantities which are tied to an expansion which is no longer affecting things close to the asymptotics. What we pick is we pick a bunch of these parameters, and again, I'm not married to this particular model. I will just use it to exemplify how I think we can impose constraints. This is the spacetime that we get out of this, where we've matched all the parameters of the model already, if possible, to the asymptotic quantities of the spacetime. And that means we can now, with that spacetime, tell apart the horizon location from the asymptotic mass. We can tell apart the horizon spin from the angular momentum. In particular, you can now produce a black hole which has a horizon but has more angular momentum, so more spin in the asymptotics than a Kerr black hole could have. You can probe the leading asymptotic corrections, which in the framework of parameterized post-Newtonian are called beta and gamma. These would be R squared contributions, 1/R² contributions in the metric. And we add one of these infinitely many near horizon corrections as well. And that's just our model of constraining things. It already has 7 parameters. So what that should tell you is we have to deal with some form of large parameter space. And so what we wanted to have is an efficient tool to understand degeneracies and constraints in that large parameter space that is as astrophysics independent as we could make it. And so I want to get to this last part here, how to disentangle the astrophysics from the geometry. So for that, let's remind ourselves what the observation actually is. Light can circle the black hole, right, and arrives at an image screen. And thanks to this very nice simulation, we can observe first light which has just come directly to the screen, and we can decompose that by light which has circled the black hole once, where once I will be very specific about in a moment, And of course, you can go on, and this exactly is what Lewis asked. It's a successive infinite tower of images. And here would be a second order image. And that then decomposes into a generic image. And a very difficult, but thanks to Avery, something that we can, or thanks to Avery and collaborators, something that we have some kind of handle on already, and hopefully more in the future, separating out these different images is the key task, right? Because we want to arrive at the bright feature which has come from light, which has at least circled the black hole once. And so there's some evidence of that already here, and I think with future observation we will gain much more evidence on that. And so taking this feature and asking how does it constrain the underlying spacetime is the goal. So we would want to have a fast tool to exclude geometries based on that observational feature. And the idea is here to do that with so-called geometric lensing bands. And so the lensing band is really just the region where light has circled the black hole once. So that would be this gray region in this example here. And now you ask, can this observed feature with the evidence of that particular observation fit into that gray region? And if it does, then, well, there's maybe some emission model which can explain that feature even in your spacetime. If it doesn't fit into that region, well, then, based on these very specific criteria, that particular spacetime is disfavored. That's the basic idea, and that's something that you can be fairly fast on. So let me very briefly also mention future prospects for that, because these observational constraints will only get better in the future. If we add more telescopes to the spaceline, this hybrid imaging will presumably gain more evidence on the additional feature. If we gain resolution, for instance, from a space-based baseline, in this plot, again, UV distance and visibility amplitude, the EHT would observe somewhere down here, the first or maybe the first and the second bump in that image. If you would add a space-based baseline, depending on how far in space you put it out, you gain additional bumps, and then you gain really also more traction on that small-scale feature in the image. Finally, polarization, I think, is a very interesting marker for that, because the polarization is expected to flip with the successive images. All right, that's just a brief summary of the observational side. On the geometric side, I want to now be precise on what I mean by has circled the black hole, because that's somewhat a sketchy term. Also, the term lensed image is in some sense up for definition. And if we want to say something rigorous, we need to stick to some definition and then at least tell what definition we're using. So here you see the definition with crossings of the equatorial plane. What happened? Crossings of the equatorial plane, where the equatorial plane is put here. And this is the far observer image. And you can classify trajectories with respect to whether they've crossed the equatorial plane once, twice, or so on. And this gives you the lensing bands in your image. And this, what is here purple, was the gray region before. And so if I tie the observational feature to having orbited the black hole once in that sense, then you can start performing that algorithm. I also want to point out that the number of times that the ray has crossed the equatorial plane is not the only definition of having circled the black hole that you can come up with. You could also come up with a definition of the number of turning points in the azimuthal angle. And the two do not agree, at least not quantitatively. They are related in a sense that they come in the same numbers, but the quantitative boundaries do not agree. And what this is a plot to exemplify that, where you see geodesics out, in and out in radial distance, and you see the azimuthal angle, or the cosine of the azimuthal angle. All these geodesics are confined to a small image region. If I go backwards in time, I can trace them out, and then they spread out. And these would all be trajectories which have the equal number of turning points, right? Just one and two. But they have different numbers of crossings of the equatorial plane. And so that's it rests on some precise definition, and I will, in the following, use this one. But in some sense, that's up for grabs, and I think it's an interesting task to do the same thing for other definitions. All right. Sorry?
Was that for Schwarzschild?
That was for, I think that is for Schwarzschild. So now we have some observational feature, and we will gain evidence on it, and we have some geometric definition, and now we can tie these two together. And in what I will be doing, then this arrives at a strict statement, namely, we exclude spacetimes for which that observational feature cannot arise from geodesics which have traversed the equatorial plane more than once. And that I'm sure is true. Whether you should actually tie that observational feature to this particular definition, well, is an assumption that you make, and that essentially you probe that assumption. And now you can perform that on Kerr spacetime to see if you recover what people already know. Here you see the parameters of that spacetime and of the observer. So you see the spin or the angular momentum, you see the mass, and you see the inclination at which you view the black hole, and you see what a Monte Carlo simulation with lots of these. So each point in the Monte Carlo is obtaining the lensing band, trying to fit that circular feature, minimizing that problem, and telling you whether it works or not. And that's the Monte Carlo probability that you get out from flat priors. And just to give you an example of how the lensing band deforms with inclination, it gets thinner, and therefore there's already in Kerr spacetime preference for certain points in that parameter space. Well, I don't want to dwell too much on this. I think this is what you can take from this. You get projected constraints on the mass. I say projected because it's all relying on Avery's sensitivity, and there's not an enormous amount of evidence that we have gained for the thin ring feature. Then the result, although here we're not sure whether it's the result or the method, disfavors high inclination. That's because if I view the black hole edge on, then this whole way of counting how many times I've circled becomes completely degenerate, and is so there's some degeneracy and some non-trivial transition that happens. And then we find a correlation between mass and spin, which has already been observed before, which is kind of interesting. If you would have a very tight mass prior, you would get a constraint on the spin. But we don't have that for M87, and in fact, here we don't impose any external priors. All right, so I would say, in general, this recovers previous work, and then you can go to this example that we've been considering and try to test deviations from Kerr. Let me remind you of the parameters, but you just get a larger of that plot, and you do get preferences on some of these parameters. Admittedly, these are kind of the most violent deviations on the geometry that you can make, but if you don't rely on black hole uniqueness, in principle, that object could have these violations. Could, for instance, have a huge angular momentum, well, and then you get a constraint from the Event Horizon Telescope observation, or from Avery.
Finding strong preference for beta in larger
garbage. That's right, but one is the GR value, right?
One is
the
GR value, and the gamma, the GR value is
also one.
Oh, then you want to say gamma must be above 3.
That's right. And there's some understanding of that because large gamma drives the lensing band to become large, while small gamma drives the lensing band to become thin. I'll actually make these points here. There's a bunch of generic statements that we can somehow extract from that. It seems that we get projected constraints which can tell apart things like the mass and the horizon size. So we get, in some sense, independent preferred regions. We get very degenerate size constraints. And you see here how the lensing band can deform in size. And here's two examples of two different parameter ranges. Here you have deformed this beta parameter. Here you have deformed the near horizon parameter. And the images really, the lensing bands really look very, very similar. So the size constraints are somewhat degenerate. And some of them can be broken by shape constraints, in a sense that if you deform the shape of the lensing band too much, again, you can't fit it with the observation. And again, from that, you get some form of constraint. All right, so I would say that this presents at least some quantitative tool to get conservative constraints from such an image. And well, I'm looking forward to more data and to apply that to further spacetimes. And so where do we go next? We might want to constrain specific theories. We might want to include non-circular deviations, because these might do very different things. I would like to account for off-equatorial emission, because only in exact equatorial emission is this truly a fully conservative constraint. And I would like to explore how additional priors on the astrophysics affect or tighten the constraints. And with that, thanks.
I think we've answered a bunch of questions during the talk, but if there's one or two more. All right, go ahead.
MST is stacking the first action.
Sorry, say again?
The action, the very early action.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, I probably skip a bunch of slides, but feel free to already start. I'll do this differently, but go ahead.
Yeah. Let us suppose we do look at it as an effective field theory under renormalization group transformation. What will happen to those two couplings, alpha 1 and alpha 2? I'm talking about 3-level renormalization group. Whether they will flow to a stronger couplings or.
That's a very good question. So first of all, I think what renormalization would do, it would break this fact that you've singled out the Gauss-Bonnet. It would introduce all sorts of curvature invariants. And then this Gauss-Bonnet has overlap with other quadratic invariants. These, some of them at least, are asymptotically free under the renormalization group flow. So they would become larger in the towards lower energies, so towards larger length scales. At least if you write down the model without the additional scalar, but with a Gauss-Bonnet squared, you would find again that the dimension full coupling would become weaker towards the infrared.
As a result, this theory, is it a stable theory or not?
What do you mean by stable in the sense of under additional fluctuations or?
Yeah, additional fluctuations.
I don't think it is.
Flow toward low energy.
No, it's not. Just like the usual Gauss-Bonnet is not. Just because you've singled out a particular invariant, you would generate all of them.
I see.
At least from symmetry, that's what I would expect.
Well, if there are no more questions, let's thank Aaron again. And I think, Kiana, will you organize the dinner tonight?
Yes.
So if you'd like to go to dinner, there's Kiana.
Well, of course I'd like to.
She'll send an email out and just respond. All right.
Thanks.